Leaders in Washington actually leveraged billions of dollars in aid in their help to various governments around the world, low and middle income countries mainly. What are U.S. intentions behind all of this foreign aid?
Well, let me first say thank you, Kaveh, for inviting me and the Schiller Institute for this discussion today. This question that you bring up of intention is very important. The current intention is geopolitical advantage. But going back a bit, that is to understand today, you have to know yesterday, President Roosevelt's intention was to end the wretched colonial system of the British Empire and all the other European major powers. And Roosevelt fought Churchill heavily on this. And this was also the intention to free the Third World of imperialism. That was the intention of President Kennedy in his many initiatives then, in the early 60s, of technology transfer to the Third World, the ending of U.S. troops in Vietnam, all these things that were attempted. Then Kennedy was assassinated, Robert Kennedy was assassinated, Reverend Martin Luther King assassinated, Malcolm X assassinated, all of these American intellectuals of stature. So I would say that the decay of USAID into a current British modeled geopolitical tool, a tool of the military-industrial complex, followed those British-directed assassinations. That's how we got here today. We have to go back a little bit in history. And they, List and Carey, defined a major role of big government, in not the private sector, in building great infrastructure internally. This idea, more advanced, has been revived by the American economist Linda LaRouche today. Now, the Russian Federation President Putin, he's recently called for a discussion of these kinds of questions among the superpowers, China, the U.S., Russia. He's called for this repeatedly at the UN Security Council, this in the midst of the pandemic and the famine. And in our opinion, President Putin is totally correct. In order to avoid a nuclear war in any region, including Southwest Asia, there has to be substantial negotiations among the superpowers. And if that were to be the case, then these solutions could be attained.
Okay, we appreciate that. That's Richard Black there, member of the Schiller Institute and representative at the UN for that institute. Now, many may outright reject any assertions that USAID is anything but aid and believe that the U.S. does have good intentions. But as you're about to see, the USAID program in Bolivia, Cuba, and in Ecuador was anything but that.
Fans delighted as Beyoncé and Jay-Z visit Havana, Cuba.
Tenía muchas ganas de conocerla porque me encantan mucho sus canciones.
Rap music popularity with Cubans is a reminder of how the U.S. government misused this in the not-too-distant past. This is the Cuban group Los Aldeanos, with lyrics like "This country is a prison" and a song titled "Rap is War." Los Aldeanos is not a group that one might expect to hear rapping in Cuba. Their inflammatory lyrics were enough to attract the U.S. government, which later funded a plan to use the group without their knowledge to spark a youth movement. The purpose? To undermine the Cuban government of Raúl and Fidel Castro. To spread that message, the U.S. government hired this man, music promoter Rutko Bozich, funded by the U.S. government through none other than USAID. According to documents obtained by Associated Press, Bozich was hired by a U.S. government contractor called Creative Associates. The contractor specialized in international development projects funded by the U.S. taxpayer agency, USAID.
They energize people and they convince people the change is possible. I think they did that.
So I think that they were exploited as a resource, they were used as a tool, and they've lost their authenticity.
In 2013, then-Bolivian President Evo Morales expelled USAID from Bolivia. He accused the agency of seeking to undermine his government.
The role that in American foreign policy is basically to support a more stable and peaceful world. The way I see that role is that it prevents crises. If you invest in people in another country so that their society becomes more peaceful and stable and prosperous, you're going to prevent crises from happening.
Let's now welcome economic expert Dennis Speed. He's a veteran political organizer, a senior member at the LaRouche Political Action Committee, and he's worked at the development of the Fusion Energy Foundation. He's written extensively for Executive Intelligence Review. Dennis, welcome. Let's take a look at the year 2000. That's while the U.S. military was bombing Iraq and Afghanistan. USAID was tasked, as it stated, with rebuilding the two countries, with an eye, as it stated, to getting the most bang out of its funding allocations. But the lines between war development aid and corporate profit, well, it had started to blur, but also turned out to be a costly endeavor for both the U.S. And for Iraq. USAID is said to even be an enabler. Do war plans happen with this intention in mind?
Well, first of all, let me just reference, I realize this will be a reversed image, but there's a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman by a person by the name of John Perkins. This has been a disastrous American policy that actually goes back to the period of the early 70s, but then accelerated, as I said, after the year 2000. How it worked was that it interfaced between private corporations and USAID. This began with companies like Bechtel, Halliburton. These were the defense contractors who actually began this policy under the Bush 41 administration between 1989 and 1992, early 93. Dick Cheney, who was then Secretary of Defense, is sort of the person that pioneered this policy at that time, privatizing the defense contracting and then interfacing this with the aid structure. So what happened was that whereas USAID, for example, back in the 60s, meant something positive, now what happened was that private corporations began to partner with the governmental structures, and they did this both in defense and in the form of development aid. What John Perkins talks about is how he, as a young man, was recruited to the intelligence agencies to do this. And so he would go in and try to get countries to commit to certain projects that were supposed to help them. Then the countries would become indebted in various ways. And as a result, they then had to allow American influence over their governmental structures. And it was always to their detriment. They usually were both indebted. And if they didn't listen, wars then ensued. So the war policy and the aid policy have become intermeshed, and this needs to be reversed as early as possible by the American people and the American government.
Okay, that's economic expert Dennis Speed. We're going to have him a little later in the program. But we're about to take a short break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up, so stay right where you are. Hello and welcome to our Info News section where we take a look at other economic news from around the world. Now, first up, we're going to take a look at the Americas and how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting that part of the world. Decades of inequality, neglect, and abuse are actually showing their ugly faces there in terms of the consequences. It's a result of systemic inequality, widespread repression, and destructive policies that have now ravaged the country from the COVID-19 pandemic. Moving now to the U.S. tax evasion, it's tax time in the U.S. The richest 1% are dodging taxes on more than one-fifth of their income. That's quite a lot. That translates into the U.S. government being denied $175 billion a year in lost revenue, I should say. Next up, Palestinian Land Day has come by. 70-plus years of Palestinian displacement is not something that can be ignored. Famous map of Palestine where the land keeps getting less and less due to the injustice that's being perpetrated against Palestinians by Israel. And finally, UK crime is costing the UK economy £36 billion increase in 5 years, and it has rocketed from £59 billion in the years 2015-16 to £95 billion in the last year.
In 2012, the U.S. taxpayer-funded organization USAID was accused again of interference in another country's political affairs, this time by Russia. Russia in turn back then terminated the organization's operations in the country.
Характер работы представителей агентства в нашей стране далеко не всегда отвечал заявленным целям содействия развитию двустороннего гуманитарного сотрудничества. Речь идет о попытках влиять через распределение грантов на политические процессы, включая выборы различного уровня и институты гражданского общества.
Meanwhile, another instance of the U.S. provoking Russia came when former VP Dick Cheney visited Georgia in 2008. During this trip, he vowed U.S. support in the form of USAID to be spent on reconstruction and humanitarian aid in that country. This occurred after the Russia-Georgia war. Post-reconstruction contracts in U.S. wars was most prominent in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. More than 70 American companies and individuals in one instance won up to $8 billion in contracts for work in those countries. Not only were those companies donors to the presidential campaigns of George W. Bush for the year 2000, Bush's running mate that year, Dick Cheney, ran one of those companies, Kellogg, Brown & Root, the subsidiary of Halliburton. The report found that nearly every one of the 10 largest contracts awarded for Iraq and Afghanistan went to companies employing former high-ranking government officials or individuals that had close ties to those agencies or to Congress.
Can the Secretary of Defense, can the Vice President, can this administration take the military to war to feed the greed of contractors?
And where does USAID stand here? It was the organization which awarded the contracts to these conglomerates and Fortune 500 companies. USAID in Yemen, in Kashmir, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. Which country is next?
My mother used to say all the time is, why are we spending so much money overseas when we have all these problems at home? I often would testify before the Congress and start by saying that if I can convince my mother that this is important, then maybe I can convince you. It's not difficult to explain why humanitarian relief is important, because the American people, 80 to 90%, say yes, if people are suffering, we should help and save them, save their lives and make their lives better.
Let's welcome back Dennis Speed, economic expert. Dennis, in our final question to you, USAID's embrace of the private sector has set disastrous precedents over the years, where the win of the private sector was often built on the losses of the people that it was supposed to help. Tell us what that exactly means.
Okay. One of the companies that did that was Bechtel, for example, and it's important to note that George Shultz, who was very involved with Bechtel, now recently deceased, former Secretary of State of the United States, together with a couple of other individuals, enacted something in the early 2000s called a revolution in military affairs. It was an American revolution. It wasn't just technology like cyber warfare and all that kind of thing. It was a way in which you created a circumstance where warfare became a form of competition. There's a document that just came out in the United States called the Army and Military Competition Chief of Staff Paper Number 2, and it says, war, in fact, is just one form of competition in a continuum of competitions. Military activities during competition can be defensive or offensive, lethal or non-lethal, etc. It goes on like that. It says war is a form of competition. First of all, that means you're not even trying to win a war, you're trying to perpetuate warfare. And what we're beginning, and we've been seeing this, is it's really a British model, perpetual warfare policy, which will be familiar to people that remember the period of the Persian-British wars of the 18, 40s or other such things back then, 50, 56, 57, when in fact the border of present-day Iran was created by the British looting then Persia. And that's the kind of policy that, unfortunately, from the time of the Kuwait policy back in 1990-91 until this very day, that the United States has also elected to pursue a kind of Anglo-American self-destroying policy, and all imperial policies ultimately fail. You have had a problem with a shift in U.S. policy over the past 20 years, particularly since the year 2000. Prior to that time, at least there was a legacy of the earlier JFK approach to aid, which was at least an honest approach. But this then shifted, particularly at the time of the 9/11, post-9/11 era. So now what you have is a kind of combination of things, whether it's food as a weapon as a policy, in a different way, medicines as a weapon. It's not really entirely an American policy. It's a policy, it's a sort of more like a transatlantic world policy, first really initiated after the fall of the Berlin Wall and then the collapse of the Soviet Union in that period of 1989 to 91 when the neocons first came to power, the Project for a New American Century, and so on. And that outlook has shaped policy. You can see that outlook in people like Mike Pompeo, for example, who represented that. So it's been completely continuous from 1990, 91 under the George Bush 41 administration up until today. It's disastrous. And is not working in the interest of the American people or the people that is apparently supposed to help.
All right, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That's economic expert Dennis Speed there. Well, it's time now to take a look at our final report in this week's program, where we take a look at two instances of U.S. interference, in this case against Russia, one that happened within Russia, and the other in Georgia, where former Vice President Dick Cheney actually visited Georgina troops while promising aid and democracy, U.S. style, to the country. It's time now for our in-depth section. First, imagine poor country is recovering from a long war and struggling to meet the basic needs of its citizens. Now, the rich country steps up and offers to help the poor country. Rich country figures it's not just an ethical thing to do, but also a smart political move. Sounds good so far. But what if the way in which rich country helps the poor country is by partnering with the world's most powerful corporations to develop the war-torn nation? Well, in return for the corporation's apparent benevolence, rich country then uses its power to remove all the roadblocks the corporations might face in doing business in poor country. Now, the corporations are free to do business as they please, and, well, they make huge profits out of the resource-rich parts of poor country, and they even continue practices for which they would face criticism in the rich country. Well, this is while poor country continues to struggle to meet the basic needs of its citizens. Except now, it has the added burden of being indebted to the rich country and its corporations. So we ask, is this ethical? You're probably wondering who, after all, is getting helped in all of this. The whole theme of the topic of this show leaves one to think, what moral ground does the U.S. stand on? Or any country, for that matter, which uses aid as a tool to help countries with aid to make a profit from the suffering of poor countries with profits of, in this case, U.S. corporations in mind, is just morally wrong. But morality does not play into U.S. politics. For example, there's nothing morally acceptable about U.S. sanctions when it is known cause deaths, like right here in Iran. USAID's embrace of the private sector goes against the very moral premise on which it was founded. Helping corporations who have a dangerous history of using their power to twist the arms of government to the detriment of its citizens, it just shouldn't happen, especially if the countries that are suffering are due to the U.S. warmongering policies, and there are quite a few of those countries around. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. From Mika Vitakva and the entire team, it's goodbye until the next program.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjat al-Islam Khakdaman.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Hello and welcome to our program. This is the sixth episode that I have the honor to be with you and talk to you about the ahkam regarding the month of Allah, Ramadan. Previously, I was talking about those specific actions, as you know, that they break your fasting. We talked about eating and drinking. We talked about intercourse or masturbation. We talked about some things. And in this episode, I'm going to talk about some things that probably we have not heard or are very little to regard, but they will break your fasting. For example, dust. If you are seeing, dense dust, for example, the wind is blowing and it just brings all of these little articles with itself. The dust is coming, for example, if it goes to your mouth and if it goes, down your throat, it breaks your fasting. Along with dust, smokes or steam. Some places are very steamy. Some places are very smoky. Smoking itself, because it produces a lot of smoke, it makes us afraid that smoke is going to come down. It's going to come down your throat. You're going to swallow that. It's going to affect you. So these are a couple of things that you need to be aware of. Smokes, places that you see they are very smoky, don't go to those places. Don't breathe in those places. If you see that the wind is blowing or some places are very dusty, some places are very, a lot of articles in the air, if you breathe, you are afraid that something will go down your throat, don't go to those places. So this is something that we need to be sure of. The next thing that breaks your fast is the matter that we see a lot of times by the people, and that's, putting your head, all of your head, down to the water. It happens a lot when people are having good time in the swimming pool or they go to the sea and they swim. And it is the month of Ramadan. Probably they don't know the fact that if all of your head is put under the water, it means that your fast has been broken. Now, there are some little points or remarks to make about that. Sometimes we want to go to the swimming pool. A lot of young people want to go to the swimming pool, even when it is the month of Ramadan. It just, soothes their hardship, the hunger or the thirst that they are enduring this month. They are going just to, relieve a little bit. It's all right. You can go to the water. You can swim. But the important thing is you need to be aware of your head. All of it should not go at the same time under the water. You can swim, you can walk, you can have a good time in the swimming pool or in the sea. It's all right. For example, if half of your head is under the water, half of it is outside, it's all right. The other half goes in, the other half comes out. It's all right. It doesn't break anything. You don't need to be afraid of the fact that your fast has been broken or not. Just the fact that all of your head, you need to be aware of that. Don't let all of it go down at the same time. So having fun is not forbidden in the swimming pools or in the seas. The last point which I would like to add is the fact that if you are doing this consciously, it breaks your fast. If somebody just unconsciously is going to be kidding or just throws you into the water and you will get, all of your body will get under the water, it doesn't break your fast because it's not you have not done that deliberately, all right? Because somebody else has done that to you. But if deliberately you do it, it breaks your fast. Thank you very much. Be with us. We will continue our program. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has started calling on the United States and NATO to expedite Ukraine's membership in the alliance in a signal to Moscow in response to a buildup of Russian forces along Ukraine's border with Russia. Volodymyr Zelensky has said NATO is the only way to end the war in Donbas. It will be more accurate to say that talk of NATO membership for Ukraine is a good way to ensure that the war in the Donbas escalates and spreads. We'll prepare for you an article written by Daniel Larrison, a contributing editor and weekly columnist for antiwar.com website. The piece is titled Keep Ukraine Out of NATO. Please stay with us for more of Daniel Larrison's article. The Biden administration risks creating a crisis with Russia with its ill-considered shows of support for the Ukrainian government. U.S. President Joe Biden expressed his unwavering support for Ukraine in a phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, and there are reports that U.S. ships may be sent into the Black Sea to send a message to Russia. President Volodymyr Zelensky has also started calling on the United States and NATO to expedite Ukraine's membership in the alliance, in a signal to Moscow in response to the buildup of Russian forces along the border between Ukraine and Russia. President Zelensky has said NATO is the only way to end the war in Donbas. Actually, it will be more accurate to say that talk of NATO membership for Ukraine is actually a good way to ensure that the war in Donbas escalates and spreads. To the extent that President Biden encourages the Ukrainian government to believe that they have U.S. and or NATO backing in the conflict, the United States could be responsible for provoking escalation by Russia or reckless moves by Ukraine. The ensuing fighting would be disastrous for millions of civilians in eastern Ukraine. Nothing is more likely to set off alarms in Moscow than revived talk of NATO membership for Ukraine. If the US and NATO started moving towards approving Ukraine's membership of NATO, it is practically guaranteed that Russia would act first to prevent that outcome. At this point, reviving NATO membership as an option paints a target on Ukraine without providing them with any of the theoretical protection that might come with NATO membership. It would be far wiser to quash this notion publicly and stress the need for de-escalation in Biden's communications with both the Russian and the Ukrainian governments. President Biden's declaration of unwavering support for Ukraine is either empty posturing or potentially dangerous overreaching. The United States has no obligations to defend or support Ukraine in a conflict with Russia, and it has no vital interests at stake that would justify taking their side. Reflexively, throwing support behind Ukraine has become a bipartisan pastime in Washington, but it has nothing to do with U.S. or allied security. The Ukrainian government should be under no illusions that the United States will bail them out if they get into trouble. But President Biden's own words create confusion as to just how far the United States would be willing to go. The same mismatch of exuberant rhetorical support and an unwillingness to follow through helped set up Georgia for disaster back in August of 2008 in the war that followed, when the Georgian government under Saakashvili misinterpreted George W. Bush's fulsome praise for Georgia and his support for their membership in the alliance as proof that the United States would intervene on their behalf in a conflict with Russia. Saakashvili escalated the conflict in South Ossetia in the expectation that the United States would back him up, only to find that the U.S. was never going to fight for Georgia after all. As Ted Gallen Carpenter concluded in a recent article, for all the previous expressions of support, the United States and its European allies were not willing to risk a dangerous, unpredictable confrontation with a great power over an obscure territorial dispute. If NATO still serves any purpose, it is supposed to be a defensive alliance that keeps its members safe from external attack. Trying to expand NATO deeper into Russia's backyard by inviting a country that is already at war would serve only to put other alliance members at risk and risk dragging the US and its European allies into an unnecessary war. Many of America's European allies recognize the risk of adding Ukraine to NATO. That is why they refused to approve a membership action plan for them back in 2008. And it is why many of these same governments will reject the idea again today. The best thing the NATO alliance could do for Ukraine right now is to close the door to future membership permanently in order to undo the mistake that NATO made by promising that Ukraine would eventually be allowed to join. It is amazing that it still needs to be said in 2021, but Ukraine's membership in NATO is never going to happen, and it would be in the best interests of all concerned to admit that. The outbreak of conflict in 2014 already showed that the United States and its allies weren't going to fight for Ukraine and wouldn't have been able to defend that country even if they had been willing to try. When they admitted the Baltic states, the alliance carelessly extended security guarantees to several countries on Russia's border that they could not effectively defend. Expanding the alliance again to include Ukraine would repeat the same mistake, but this time on a much larger scale, and Russia would call NATO's bluff before the ink on the map was even dry. Atlanticists like to say that Russia does not get a veto over alliance membership, But the Russian government has already demonstrated before that it can and will exercise the veto if it is sufficiently provoked. NATO shouldn't make the same mistake twice, and the United States should be discouraging the Ukrainian government from believing that it can end the conflict by calling for more Western support. Moreover, Russia says the United States and other NATO countries are deliberately turning Ukraine into a powder keg by increasing arms supplies to Kiev and inflaming tensions in the country's volatile east. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov was quoted by the Russian news agencies as making the statement recently following an uptick in violence between Ukrainian government troops and pro-Russian forces in the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbass. Sergei Ryabkov said, "The United States and other NATO countries are deliberately turning Ukraine into a powder keg. If there is any aggravation, we of course will do everything to ensure our security and the safety of our citizens wherever they are." Sergei Ryabkov added, "But Kiev and its allies in the West will be entirely responsible for the consequences of a hypothetical exacerbation." Ukraine, for its part, has accused Russia of amassing thousands of military personnel on its northern and eastern borders, as well as on the Crimean Peninsula. Meanwhile, NATO has called on Russia to withdraw its troops from the near Ukraine's eastern border, which the alliance claims is Moscow's biggest buildup of forces since 2014. Moscow says the military buildup poses no threat to any country and is for defensive purposes since two U.S. warships are due to arrive in the Black Sea. Sergei Ryabkov said the U.S. warships in the Strategic Sea had to observe safety distances, saying their deployment was provocative and that the risk of unspecified incidents was very high. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Ryabkov said, "There is absolutely nothing for American ships to be doing near our shores. This is purely a provocative action, provocative in the direct sense of the word. They're testing our strength, playing into our nerves. They will not succeed." Kiev and Moscow have traded blame in recent weeks for a spike in violence in the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine, where Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces have been fighting since 2014. The armed confrontations began when a wave of protests in Ukraine overthrew a democratically elected government and replaced it with a pro-Western administration. The majority in those areas refused to endorse the new administration in Kiev. The new Ukrainian government then began a crackdown on the mainly ethnic Russians in the eastern Ukraine, who in turn took up arms and turned the two regions of Donetsk and Lugansk, collectively known as the Donbass region, into self-proclaimed republics. Kiev and its Western allies accused Moscow of having a hand in the crisis. However, Moscow has denied the allegations. Relations between Moscow and Kiev further deteriorated when the Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea rejoined Russia following a referendum in 2014. More than 90% of those who took part in the referendum in Crimea voted in favor of unification with Russia.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam, I be. Allah, my Lord. His word, Quran. Muhammad, Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask his blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and other life forms. You are listening to Youth Station, brought to you by IRIB English Radio. I am Zainab, and totally excited to have in the studio special... Well, he's not that special. You know what? Never mind.
That was a good welcome. Do you ever want... Oh, this, by the way, I'm Mehdi, and I know you guys are excited. It's just this lady who's not. Anyway... Do you ever wonder about immortality?
All the time.
But they say, like, if you could live forever, you'd lose all your relatives, friends, and family. But imagine if they could live too.
I think about immortality very often, and I think it's horrible.
But why?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. كل نفس ذائقة الموت ونبلوكم بالشر والخير فتنة وإلينا
Every soul will taste death, and we test you with evil and with good as trial, and to us you will be returned.
If you think about losing out on everything else, that might be horrible, but everything's there as it is. So is it horrible as it is?
It is. What? No, okay, see, first of all, the world is going to be overcrowded, and the thought of that is giving me a panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
And secondly, I don't necessarily favor everyone who's already around. I wouldn't mind if some of them just passed away casually. And also, why be immortal? Like, just the fact that I am a believer, I don't know about other people, but I believe in the afterlife, right? Even the thought of that kind of scares me every once in a while.
But, besides the Orthodox Jews, certain Jews, they've got this understanding that when the Messiah arrives, that this very earth is going to become heaven, apparently.
Uh-huh.
So we're going to live here forever and ever. Well, Orthodox people, they probably did have an understanding of heaven and hell besides this material world, but apparently these people, they have this understanding that this earth is going to be our heaven or hell.
So they basically turned like Dawlatan Karima,
yeah.
They believe in regard with Sahib al-Zaman alayhi salam, and they turn it literal, right?
Yeah, so yeah. What's your answer? What do you think about that then? If that happens, isn't that perfect? Like, you don't need to die.
I love death. No, this has nothing to do with depression, clinical, occasional, seasonal, or any of its forms.
Mm-hmm.
And
or the fact that you get tempted to kill yourself.
No. I'm not suicidal. Ladies and gentlemen, before you call the hotline, hear me out. I'm not even a super-duper pious person. Now that I think about it, I'm not even a very good Muslim. There, I said it. But I think I owe it to the ahadith from Amir al-Mumineen, Ali alayhi salam, and how he constantly encourages us to really believe in the fact that this world is fleeting and none of it's nothing. Like, the suffering nor the joy, none of it is going to last. And at the end of the day, we're going to fall and die, or die and then fall, depending on where we're standing.
So why do you have to die? Like, why do you have to die?
Because everything has an expiry date, I guess.
Hmm. Yeah.
Except, like, God. I think, like, everything material has to die, right? Do angels have to die, per se?
Wajhullah, mm-hmm. Which is the face of Allah, translated literally, that's going to remain.
Because in the Quran, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about the sur, the horn that is going to be blown into by Israfil, his angel, everything falls dead.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم ونفخ في الصور فصعق من في السماوات ومن في الأرض إلا من شاء الله ثم نفخ فيه أخرى فإذا
And the horn will be blown, and whoever is in the heavens and whoever is on the earth will fall dead, except whom Allah wills. Then it will be blown again, and at once they will be standing, looking on.
So let's stick to us mere mortals.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
Look, I don't know how, I'm not sure how I feel about it. Yeah, I'm not sure.
As if.
Yeah. Look, كل نفس ذائقة الموت.
Absolutely.
And probably all our listeners, they probably know and have heard what I'm going to say, that when you eat an apple, mm-hmm. the apple dies and you stay, right? The apple's gone. So when Quran says, well, yeah, we hurt apples and all other things around us. So when you eat something, it's when you taste something, you're the one who's lasting compared to the taste that's there, right?
Yeah.
So when the Quran says "Kullu nafsin da'iqatul maut," that every soul is tasting, is going, well, it's tasting death because it says da'iqa, like it
prolonged.
It's an action that you're performing. So if that's the case, then the nafs is gonna outlive the taste, death itself,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And about death, in Surah Al-Mulk, Allah says, "الَّذِي خَلَقَ الْمَوْتَ وَالْحَيَاةَ لِيَبْلُوَكُمْ أَيُّكُمْ أَحْسَنُ عَمَلًا." So, if death was going to be the end of us or the last of us, then whom is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala going to put to test?
Right.
Right? So, if Allah says, "I created death and life, so I put to test and see which one of you has got better actions?" If we're not going to be there after death, then how is there any test, right?
Mm-hmm. So you think the philosophy is death is just testing us? But, you know, come to think of it, it would be the best means through which we could be tested, whether it's our own death or the death of someone we love or someone we hate. In all honesty, I've never hated anyone enough to wish death upon them.
Yeah.
But... in all fairness, if we were not trialed with death and we really felt in our heart that, oh, I am invincibly immortal, there is nothing we would not resort to. It's because we have death that, on one hand, we feel like we need to live life to the fullest.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, we sort of search for some sort of meaning because we feel like, oh, this time is so fleeting and I don't make something out of it, I'm gonna die. And I'm going to be, like, useless.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have lived my life in total and absolute waste. And, you know, I'm going to freak out.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, like, both for the YOLO creed. YOLO creed that you die once and you got to live your life to the fullest. Death brings meaning. And also for those who are, like, there is a life after death. You don't live once. You live all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You die once. Again, death is the milestone that brings the meaning. And then for the atheist as well. I'm going to die, then what?
Yeah. Actually, yeah. For so them, it's completely different. It's like it's larger and more serious than it is for us.
Exactly.
Well, it's not that serious for them, but it is serious. I don't know. I can't decipher between the two, but like, yeah, it's serious for them too.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
no matter how we look at it, death is really what defines how we live our lives. And I think that's so beautiful. Romantic, even. I'm going to write a book on this.
On death.
Yeah. You're
in
just
Islam.
Like, you're a...
I'm a pessimist?
You're a bombshell of inspiration. Please
or
continue.
Suicide. About this verse only, strictly speaking.
Mm.
It says, لِيَبْلُوكُمْ أَيُّكُمْ أَحْسَنُ عَمَلًا. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is saying that I want to see whose action is better.
Mm.
So over here, it's almost as if you've not been created to be tested or to be punished. So you're not going to be, you're not created to be punished.
What are you created for then?
لِأَحْسَنُ عَمَلًا. So you have been created to excel, isn't it? Well, that's not me, that's Allah Tabatabai. Yeah, he says that. So he's like, you. That's why you've been created, to excel and perform good actions, and you compete with each other in these positive traits and these positive actions. There's something that
so
Allah Tabatabai said.
You've been created to be the best version of yourself. To live your best life.
Live your best life.
In the like, in the spiritual, godly sense of it, you know.
Yeah.
Not like Instagram's hashtag living my best.
Yeah, life. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And that's beautiful, bro.
Yeah.
That is so beautiful for us to come to this realization, for us to have it redefined for us, and really adjust it in a way that we haven't been created to be. To tormented and suffer and constantly riddled with pain and anxiety and distress and then sin and then go to hell. No, that wasn't the objective of our creation at all. We've been created to be the best
versions of
exactly.
ourselves.
That's
yeah, he was saying that. He was saying that, and those who have been created, besides the ones who perform the good deeds, have been created for the ones who perform the good deeds. I don't know if that makes any sense.
We will continue this discussion maybe at some point if death does not take us first.
Take her first, please.
You know what? I don't even mind. Thank you so very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness. And my love is strong. Because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran, You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.